Welcome to the Act in Context podcast. My name is Tim Gordon.
And my name is Joanne Steinwachs.
We have a really cool episode for you today. We're going to be talking about complex trauma. And rather than having a guest, Joanne and I are actually going to recreate a conversation that we had together over dinner on this very topic that we thought that
we've had this conversation multiple times. You know, we've been talking about this together for a long time. Both Tim and I have worked and do work with people who have really complicated and difficult trauma histories, you know. And we think that there's not enough information out there for people who are, first of all, struggling with complex trauma, and second of all, treating complex trauma.
Absolutely.
So we'd like to speak from our own clinical experience. So, full disclosure, you know, there's no research to support this, but there are decades of clinical experience between us.
Absolutely.
It supports this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I want to just kind of preface this as well with saying that trauma work gets a lot of publicity. It gets a lot of marketing pull within the world of psychotherapy and treating mental health related problems. It seems that trauma related problems, especially the types of things that we're going to be talking about today, are a really hot topic for therapists. And I think mostly because there's so much minutia and complexity around how these cases are described, around what things clinicians can do. And it can be very confusing when you're trying to figure out, how do I help somebody that has a severe trauma history?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. And when I consult, because I do a lot of consulting for people with complex cases, what I hear over and over again is, give me a set of guidelines. Give me a set of rules. Tell me what to do. And I actually have one.
That's right.
I really do. So for those of you who are familiar with ACT, you may not be familiar with this. It's pretty old school ACT. It's the ACT question, and it kind of lays out how ACT approaches living, really. And it goes like this. Given a distinction between me and what I'm struggling with, am I willing to have this fully and without defense as it is, not as it says it is, and move in the direction of my values in this present moment?
So hang on, let's slow that down. Let's break that down.
Yeah, okay.
The first part.
The first part is mind-boggling.
Given a distinction.
Yep. I am not my trauma. My client is not their trauma. My reactions to my client's trauma is not me.
Yes.
You know, because that's something I really want to talk about today, is our own responses to hearing really, really intense trauma histories, and how you can have it fully and without defense as a therapist. Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, and we start out with that. Yeah. Given a distinction. Well, how do you do that?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Do you want us to just hang out there? Okay. Given a distinction with me, am I willing to have this fully and without defense? For me, the next two go together, especially for trauma. Well, the next three. Fully and without defense as it is, not as it says it is. Trauma says it's happening again. You know, you're caught again. Right? You hear it all the time from people who are struggling with trauma.
Yes.
Struggling with flashbacks and body memories and just the kind of gruesome scarring that happens after someone's been brutally, brutally traumatized.
Yeah. And also not wanting to experience any of that stuff.
Right.
Because it's coming up. Those flashbacks are coming up. So how do I avoid those? How do I not have those?
Right.
So I want to break down even those three parts.
Mm-hmm.
Willing to have that. Like, that's powerful just in and of itself.
Which doesn't mean you like it or prefer it or want it, you know? And if you go to the end of the question, there's a little piece there. In this moment, in this present moment, we're not asking, you're never asked to do it for the rest of your life. It's just this moment. Are you willing for this moment to have what you have as it is? Which isn't wonderful, by the way. And I really want to talk about that for sure.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So are you willing to have it
as it is?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. fully and without defense.
As it is.
As it is.
Right. And move towards your values, move towards what matters to you in this present moment. So my thinking is if someone is in therapy to deal with their trauma, they are moving towards their values. Right there. Just that.
Absolutely.
You know? So moving towards your values, should I tell the typhoon story?
I love the typhoon story.
Okay. So there's bad language in this. So if you don't like the word shit, don't listen. So a long time ago, and I have permission, all the stories I say, my clients said this to me, you know, they'll say it to me and I'm like, oh my God, that's amazing. Can I use it? Can I tell other people that you just said that? I won't use your name or anything like that, but can I share that? And so everything I talk about with clients, I have permission to talk about.
And that's a helpful caveat for us to share, is that we're very aware of health information privacy compliance. And that's something that we're definitely self-policing on this podcast. So just in case our listeners are a bit hyper-vigilant about that. Yeah, that's something that we're definitely.
Or if you're in therapy and you're worried that your therapist would disclose something to on a podcast. I mean, that's very disturbing.
Yeah.
So no, we're not going to, and all the cases that we talk about are disguised.
Yeah.
You know, we're not talking, oftentimes I'm blending cases, don't you? Right.
That's exactly, I was thinking a lot of my cases that I talk about, I like to talk about composites. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
we're blending these
patterns that move. Well, we'll talk about that later.
Yes.
Where was I?
Well, you were going to tell the typhoon story.
Oh, the typhoon story.
And it's good.
So, yeah, it is really good. So a long time ago, a trauma, amazing, amazing, extraordinary woman that I worked with a terrible background. She said, Joanne, you know, in my life, it rains a lot. And I'm thinking, oh, how poetic. You know, this is lovely. I was early in my career.
Oh.
And she said, yeah, it rains shit. And I was like, yeah. It kind of does rain shit in your life. Yeah. And she said, some days I wake up in the morning and it's just like a shit fog or a slight sprinkling of shit. And I'm like, true. And some days I wake up and it's a shit typhoon. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yep, that's absolutely true. Unfortunately, more days than not is a shit typhoon.
Yeah.
And she said, if I get out of the door and lean towards the things that matter to me, that's a stellar success. And I said, absolutely. You know?
Yeah.
So I think we need to calibrate. When people are talking about moving towards their values, oftentimes these values are very grandiose, you know? Be the best parent I can be for my kids.
Go back to school.
Right. Yeah. Get my doctorate, you know? Whatever. Become a super athlete, whatever. And that's what we think of for values. But value is just knowing what matters to you on a moment by moment basis and making your decisions that bring you closer to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and make it more salient in your life. We'll talk about values a lot on this podcast.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
There's something special inside of that notion though. And you know, you mentioned it earlier, and I'm going to underscore it here. Coming to therapy may be a values-driven move. That may be an act of defiance against what someone's trauma tells them to do.
Mm-hmm. Which is to run and keep silent, don't speak.
Yeah.
Especially if we're talking about people who have been, you know, sexually traumatized from an early, early age and by family members or people that who are in positions of trust.
Yes.
Don't tell is a massive, massive part of that.
Absolutely.
So someone telling someone about what happened to them is incredibly courageous. Incredibly courageous.
Yeah.
So I don't forget that when I'm working with someone with trauma. You know, I just don't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's take that as a jumping off point, Joanne. And I'd like to just spend a moment maybe giving a little bit of education to some of our listeners, because some people might not know what we mean by complex trauma. Mm-hmm. So when I refer to complex trauma, I'm generally referring to somebody who has a history of traumatic experience. So it tends not to be a single episode. I deal a lot with folks who have a history, a childhood history of sexual abuse, sometimes, oftentimes, pre-verbal, meaning mm-hmm. like before they could speak, right?
Right.
Sexual trauma histories.
Mm-hmm. And also physical trauma and neglect trauma.
Yes.
You know, because when you're being sexually abused as a child, you are probably being physically abused. You have to be. Yep. And of course you are neglected. Of course you are. Even if you're fed, you are neglected. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think that even this part of the conversation can be really helpful to just underscore like what it is exactly that we're talking about. And mm-hmm. some of the presentation that I see in my practice is folks who are trying to avoid a number of different sensations,
mm-hmm.
who are trying to live their lives. They're trying mm-hmm. to maintain relationships. Yeah. They're trying to, you know, they're just get by.
Right. Exactly. And absolutely. I want to talk about another thing too with complex trauma.
Yes.
Oftentimes it is the person's entire life experience. Everyone, all the time, everywhere.
Yes.
You know, it's not like one person. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. But for some people, it's just the way life is, which is heartbreaking.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. And I think a common complaint, if you will, kind of across the spectrum that I see with mm-hmm. complex trauma, and I'd love to hear you speak to this as well, Joanne, is folks won't necessarily come in for the trauma per se.
Mm-mm.
They'll know that that happened and that that has probably impacted them quite negatively, but it usually has to do with a lot of other things around their daily functioning and living, whether it be, you know, eating,
right.
or
eating is a big one.
Yeah.
Alcohol abuse, drug abuse, you bet.
Yeah. Relationship breakdown.
Right.
Difficulties in parenting.
Yeah. Things like that, that seem sort of garden variety.
Yeah.
Therapy. Oh, yeah, we can knock this out in 12 sessions. No.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is the case always, but I've had clients that I've worked with for a long time say that they actually tested out a fair number of therapists before they chose me, you know?
Yes.
They're looking to see, like, if I move a little towards this, how will this person follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Will even pick it up, right? And really, really ultra sensitive.
Hang on, that was so profound, right? Like, mm-hmm. will they follow me?
Yeah.
Will they even pick it up?
Right. Exactly.
Can I say something a little evocative?
Yeah, you know who you're talking to?
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know,
ask the podcast listeners
that I'm such a you know, this shit disturber, right?
Right.
So. Not all therapists are created equal.
No.
And I don't mean to speak derogatorily about anybody who works in my community or any therapist at all. But there are some therapists who let's say are really engaged with their clients, who are really attentive. And there are other therapists where that might not be their style, or they might be doing something just entirely different. And so what we're talking about here is a type of way of being in a room where you are attentive to what's going on with somebody, and where, you know, you yourself are practicing that statement that you had.
Am I willing to have this fully and without defense as it is? You know, and you know, just because you're a therapist doesn't give you a pass on having your own trauma history.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who said, when you look into the abyss, sometimes the abyss looks back?
Yes.
Is it Goethe? Something like that. It's a great quote. But when you're dealing with hearing some of the just really unspeakable things that people have survived, it's very, very difficult. Even if you don't have a, you know, complex trauma history, but you know, knowing that we live in a world where this hideous stuff happens, not just happens, but is happening and is a yes. billion-dollar, gajillion-dollar industry, you know, that's really hard to wrap your head around. It's so much easier to do smoking cessation, mm-hmm. not sensation.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I completely and utterly get it. If, you know, if you've seen a client and you're like, not for me, nope, not going there. I've actually done that. There's times in my life when my daughter was really young where I refused trauma clients, people who came to me. I was like, I can't do this. I cannot be the mother I want to be and be the therapist you need. I can't do it.
Yeah. And so, also what an incredible piece of self-awareness though.
Yeah.
To be able to put up that boundary to take care of you.
Let's talk about that. Can we talk about that? Because I think boundaries are super, they're vital for working with people who've been through this.
Yeah.
And the situations often lead towards, you know, just really sloppy boundaries with, you know, when you have someone that you really care about and, you know, they have a terrible, terrible history. And at, you know, 2 a.m. on Saturday, they have an explosive memory and they call you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course you want to be there. Of course you want to be the person who hears it. Yes, of course. And sometimes people get into that trap, you know, clinicians get into that trap. I call it the Mighty Mouse trap. Here I am to save the day.
Yes.
You know? So I see clinicians early on in trauma work having kind of a cowboy attitude, you know? Oh yeah, I work with trauma, man, you know. You know, dude, you can't tell me anything that I can't handle. And yeah. I think it's a developmental stage we really have to get through as quickly as possible because it's truly obnoxious.
Yeah. And I want to touch on that for a second. I think mm-hmm. that also, I like that you described it as a developmental stage.
Oh, yeah.
And it being obnoxious. I know I was an obnoxious teenager. Like I'm an obnoxious adult. So
sometimes kind of, yeah.
But I remember when I became an attachment and trauma specialist. That was my job title. Mm-hmm. And I remember like I had colleagues who were like, ooh, that's the work you do. Ooh, I wouldn't get anywhere near that. That's, and so I get how that, and it can feel very powerful, that Mighty Mouse sort of persona, because
I could do this. Aren't I special? Right.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You're doing hard work that
other therapists can do.
Other people shy away from.
Right.
And in fact, something that was really reinforcing to me early in my career around doing that attachment and trauma work
mm-hmm.
is people were saying like, I've never been able to go here with a therapist before.
Right, right, right. Exactly.
So I like that you described it as a developmental stage because I'm sure I was there.
Oh yeah, we all are. You know, you can't not be. And I want to speak to that, you know, because I think that that is the first flinch that we have as a human being when we really contact trauma. What we're listening to is the fact, the truth, that human beings can be in situations where they are completely vulnerable and completely exploited, and no one will take care of it. No one will come. No one will stop it. Mm-hmm. And it happens over and over again.
Yeah.
And it may not be that you are trafficked by your prostitute mother, you know, when you were four, starting when you were four. Yes. But something like this could happen to anyone, you know. You go into the hospital, you get misdiagnosed, and the nurses and doctors won't listen to you.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So this first flinch, I think, to let that truth land, we're letting go of a safe and just world to do this work. You know, why are people traumatized? Why does this happen to them? There's no reason. What? So if you get back into the savior role, you know, by God, you know, I'm going to make this right, you know?
Yeah.
It's not about your client in any way, shape, or form. It's about you not being able to tolerate what your client is telling you about the nature, part of the nature of reality.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know? It's like, I don't want that bit.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's, so, isn't that powerful? Because we've had in the trauma literature world, right? We've had such a hard time identifying, like, why is it that this percentage of the population who, let's say, gets deployed for active combat or...
Yeah, I know you work with the military, so you have a lot to say about that for sure.
Yeah, right. And why is it that this percentage of the population comes back with PTSD?
Right.
Then this 12% of that population ends up with full-blown complex trauma. Like,
right.
How do we how do we work with that? I mean, there's been some wonderful clinicians, theorists. Donald Meichenbaum is one of them that I'm thinking of. Peter Levine, Bessel van der Kolk, people who have come up with ideas about and tried to create explanations for why trauma happens. Right. But I love how you said that. Like, we just don't know why some people respond this way.
We don't know. And we don't know if we will respond that way.
Yeah.
And like the abyss looks back.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Joanne, I'm arrogant enough to say this after the conversation.
You arrogant?
I think that we as contextualists,
yeah,
and I don't want to just say ACT people, because you and I both have a long history before learning ACT.
Yeah.
As a technology and then as an approach. Mm-hmm. But I think that people who are using this contextual approach, this behavioral science stuff, mm-hmm. I think are uniquely situated to treat complex trauma and to do really good work with it.
Exactly. Are you willing to have this fully and without defense? That's the pivot, you know? Not, are you willing to spend the rest of your life doing all kinds of avoidance moves that I'm going to teach you that are actually quite powerful, but not reliable, you know?
But right there, what you just said there, to me, takes the explanation, the insight part, mm-hmm. out of the mm-hmm. complex yeah. trauma treatment. Mm-hmm. And instead it says like, hey, what you do works for a reason. Mm-hmm. Let's acknowledge that. It might not be attractive. Mm-hmm. But it works for whatever reason.
Do you think now would be a good time to tell the podcast audience what I told you about what I realized about body memories and memories in general?
Oh, I have been waiting for this. Yes. Okay. Yes.
So I'm not kind of a geek. I'm a massive geek. I'm a massive, massive behavioral
big
geek.
Time. Big time.
Big time. Now. Just, yeah. We shouldn't go down that path because it will bore everyone. Coming back to the point, I never had a behavioral explanation that made sense to me. Well, there was no behavioral explanation about why people have these, what are called triggers. I'm making air quotes for those of you who are listening. Yeah. And I just want to say, first of all, I never use the word trigger, and I always correct it because it's not accurate. Let me tell you why. So when you have a new experience, you can be my answerer. When you have a new experience, Tim, what do you reference to make sense of it?
Past experiences.
Past experience, right?
Yeah.
So if I have an experience of someone being snotty and mean to me or just rude, mm-hmm. right? You know, I might reference my previous experience. And I may have a really, really diverse bunch of information back there.
Yes.
Right? People with complex trauma histories, first of all, often don't have a diverse sort of data bank. And secondly, they're going to go to the most dangerous part of it to make sense of it.
Yes.
Right. Right. So you see people with trauma histories who either avoid human contact or are so conflict phobic, it's just impossible for them to live.
Right? Yeah.
Because a raised voice or some irritation for them immediately cues the memory of an event, a flashback. So when someone is, air quotes, triggered, they're not triggered. They're remembering vividly something from their past.
Yes.
You know? And it's an activity that happens. It's a normal activity that happens. We are reminded.
History. It's a direct experience.
There's no way you cannot be reminded of what happened to you before unless you get a really good head injury. That might work. You know,
remind me. Mary had a little.
Right, exactly. Mary had a little laugh. Yeah, it's just there. And when I've told people this, when I've laid it out, you know, there's no way you could not have these vivid, intense, multi-sensory memories. There's no way. The sigh of relief is so powerful.
Yes.
You know? My work is never, never to make that stop, although I hear clients say it to me a lot. And yeah. my work is, and my client's work is, since this is not something that can be changed unless you go live in a, well, you can't go anywhere where this can't find you. There's nowhere you can go, nope. Right? Nowhere.
Relocation therapy does not work.
Does not work, you know? Yeah. Avoiding human therapy does not work. If there's nowhere you can go and there's no predictability about when you will be reminded, right? And people tell you that it's a special, weird, disturbing, psycho, crazy thing, mm-hmm. right?
Dissociative disorder, not otherwise stated.
Right, right. Not otherwise specified. Sure, yeah. People look at you like, what? You know?
Yes.
And there's no way to get rid of it unless maybe if you drug yourself until you drool, sometimes it takes the edge off. But sometimes not.
Sometimes not, actually. Sometimes, yeah, I like not. That.
Sometimes it makes it worse, actually, depending on your history. I don't need to go into detail there. So if you explain it, if you think about it, like I'm being reminded of something unspeakable that happened to me. I'm not crazy. Mm-hmm. I'm not losing my mind. I am reminded. Okay. Am I willing to have it as it is? I'm being reminded. Not as it says it is. It's happening again. And move in the direction of my stated values. This is the work. Have it accurately. My clients know this about me. I'm an obsessive, meticulous accuracy person. You know, I always slow people down, you know, going, no, wait, that's not it. Let's be cute. Yeah. Let's be accurate. Because it's so necessary to deal with what you're dealing with really as it is, as it truly is. So it's not some sort of mythical thing that is done to you.
I like that.
Right? Trigger means that you have no control. You have no volition. You have no nothing, right? Yes. Which isn't true.
There's something powerful in there, though, mm-hmm. That I think as somebody who does the work, even having done this for a long time, even hearing you say that now, like mm-hmm. on this day, Joanne, is incredibly validating to me. Mm-hmm. And is something that I experience over and over again with my clients, which is to say, you're not broken.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
This is an experience that you have. You tried hard to fight it.
Right. Right.
No dice. You can't run fast enough to escape this.
Right. Your brain is behaving the way normal human brains behave with this history.
Yeah.
You know, people who cannot remember things are usually demented.
Yeah.
Right? This is a problem.
Yes.
Your brain and people who cannot remember dangerous things die young.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. We have a special name for them in science, right? That species is called extinct.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Absolutely. So when people realize that this is just the normal working of a human brain, this is how we're built. You know, all of those impossible demands that they had, you know, of themselves. I can't have this physical sensation in my body.
Yes.
You know, that's one. Body memories, big one. Okay, you have a physical sensation in your body. You need to make sense of it because that's what we do. And you reference your previous history. Well, what does previous history tell you about physical sensation?
That it's not safe. That it's dangerous.
Or you're being harmed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You're actually being harmed if you feel that. Well, I want to talk about that too. So a lot of times people, you know this, right? They develop an ability to sort of numb
when they're
really, really awful stuff.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're, you know, you're 4, 5, 6, 7 years old and you figured out how to numb, you figured out how to, you know, float on the ceiling and just watch. If a sensation breaks through that numbing, what does it mean?
It is not good.
It is not good. You just went to a whole higher order of danger.
Yeah.
Right? So physical sensations become a danger cue.
So let's pause here for one second. Because, Joanne, you and I are kind of nerding out on complex trauma. And so some of our listeners might not be aware of this, and I know I referenced it anyways, earlier, but this idea of dissociation, right?
Right.
The ability to be able to numb out those experiences. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is so pervasive. And I'd like to share this example with you. Maybe we could work mm-hmm. through this example, sure. almost like a case consult with how you're conceptualizing this, because your conceptualization of those body memories is brilliant. And I think unquestionably, I mean it, Joanne, I think it's unquestionably helpful to therapists who are considering this trauma work. And not just from a, I'd say, behavioral perspective, but mm-hmm. if you want to do something that's backed by like basic science, this is going to help you unquestionably.
Right.
So I'm thinking of a client who is standing in a coffee shop and they're very good at dissociating. They're very good at closing down any of those sensations that they don't want to feel.
Let's talk about dissociating before we go on.
Please.
Because everyone sees that as some sort of special, you know, bad superpower, you know?
Yeah. Well, you described it earlier, like a, almost like a mythical kind of...
Right. You know, yeah. like this, you know, thing that's... Dissociation is just a normal iteration of directing your attention. That's all it is. So you think about it. I like to think about it like dinosaurs, you know? Some of those dinosaurs got really weird looking, right?
Okay.
Right? I mean, just weird looking, right?
Yeah.
Because selection by consequences, this worked better, this worked better, this worked better, this worked better.
It makes sense to have spikes on my back or to grow armor.
Right, have a big thing hanging off my nose, right?
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So if you think about behavior that way, choose action, doing things that way, you're going to choose something over and over again. You're going to take the path that either makes it better or makes it less bad. Mm-hmm. Right?
Absolutely.
And I think there's some evidence to say that some people have a better sort of physiological ability to do that, you know, but mm-hmm. I don't think that it's not something everyone can do.
Yes.
So it's that very deep turning away from, not looking at, right?
Yeah.
Ignoring. It's ignoring, taken to its most convoluted dinosaur-like extreme.
And is perfectly useful.
Absolutely. Like it. It's perfectly useful. Well, it was perfectly useful. It's probably not in your daily life now.
Well, and so that brings me back to the example. So they're standing.
Let me pause here. Okay, I'll come back to that.
Sure.
It's not that the activity of turning your attention, ignoring things, isn't useful. You do need that. So dissociation isn't something you get rid of. You just wind it down.
I like that.
Right?
I like that.
Yeah, you don't need to dissociate to ignore your brother-in-law at Christmas.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Right? You don't. Yeah.
That's not the right tool for the job right now.
No. Okay, yeah. Go ahead. So,
they're standing in line at a coffee shop, mm-hmm. right? They're waiting to get their morning cup of coffee mm-hmm. in a place where they haven't been attacked, in a place where they usually feel safe. Mm-hmm. And somebody who is just not being very cognizant, you know, maybe they're on their phone, standing mm-hmm. a little bit too close in line mm-hmm. behind this client, and that their proprioception gets fired up. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And they can't even explicitly point to it.
Right. They
couldn't say like, oh, okay, it was this right. event. Right, that was the antecedent.
Let's talk about the pattern of doing that, the desire to do that later on. Keep going.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so they leave the coffee shop having a trauma flooding experience, mm-hmm. calling you up for a crisis session saying, great, mm-hmm. now I can't even go to the coffee shop mm-hmm. without my trauma infecting my life. I had a panic attack in there. I can't do this.
I like the word infecting. You know, because it leads to, what do you do with an infection? You cure it.
Antibiotics, cut it out.
Done. Right. And if you don't cure an infection, what happens? You die.
Go septic.
Body shuts down. Gone. So let's go back to the, you know, you can't tell if too close behind you, you know, your feeling of people around you gets fired up, right? And you don't even realize it's happening. So when people start talking about avoiding trigger cues, avoiding triggers, right? It starts a process that is, I don't know how to say it, just fucking impossible, You know?
I like that.
Right? It's just completely impossible to avoid triggers.
Yes.
Triggers. It's like saying, you know, well, if you think about it, avoid anything that makes you think about your kid.
Good luck.
Reminds you of your kid.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So if you see it as what it is, it's a reminder, it's a recall, it's a memory. You are reminded of. Do you know what it was in the coffee shop that cued it? No. No, you don't. The issue isn't to say what cued it so I can avoid that in the future. The issue is okay, how do I learn how to be cued and get my coffee?
I like that.
You know? I can panic in the car, but I really do need some coffee right now.
Yeah.
Right? And that's doable. That's totally, well, it's not easily doable, but it's completely doable.
It's a workable agenda. And it's, I love that the whole ACT statement was right there, the ACT question, in what you just described in that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think when you lay it out to someone like that, it becomes more comprehensible. It becomes more, oh, this is just an evolved dinosaur of normal behavior. Yeah, one of the really weird ones with the nose thing.
Yeah, right? I love it.
Right. I mean, if you just iterate, it goes that direction. Go ahead.
It's also non-pathologizing.
No.
That's what strikes me here.
Yeah, right? This is what normal humans do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, those of you, people who went through what you went through and didn't do what you did, died.
Yes.
They're not here. Or they're functionally dead and walking up and down a street, you know, prostituting.
Yeah.
Or doing it to their own children.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So you learned something that protected you. Of course you got really, really, really good at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a kind and validating way, I think, to address how, number one, hard this is, but also historically, right? Like, because it's difficult for us to come in contact with that history and to own that. Because isn't it natural to be like, oh, I must be a really messed up person that I do this, Joanne?
Right, right, right. Yeah, exactly. You know, nobody that I know does this, except in the movies, and they're all crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, or funny. Ha ha.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
So
I want to come to something you said, though. I mean, because this is my obsession with accuracy.
Yes.
Right. It's not just kind. It's not just whatever else you said. It's accurate.
Hmm.
So I want to talk a little bit about normal distress. Can I talk about that a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay. So a lot of us do have two sort of valences or two sort of apprehensions about what's going on. Either it's catastrophically painful and we're all going to die and I'm going to be first or last, whichever's worse, or I'm fine. Right? Those are the two. So you see people who have something, one of those happen. It's true. It's happening. I'm never going to be able to live, or bam, I'm fine.
Yes.
Right? And either way is invalidating. Because it's not accurate.
Hmm.
You're not fine. You know this. You know you're not fine. And some part of you knows that, you know, it's happening, they're shooting at me again, isn't accurate. So we come to accuracy, which is what's happening as it is. As it is. And sometimes as it is sucks.
Yeah.
Right? I am being reminded of being shot at. I am being reminded of being gang raped.
Yeah.
Well, that's fun.
Yeah.
Right? But what I see over and over and over again in my life too, is when I get really into that meticulous, pristine accuracy, my brain and body settle.
Hmm.
And with clients, it's the same way.
But I even like how you described that spectrum and being like, mm-hmm. You know, you don't need to expect yourself to be fine, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't need to also expect yourself to be in full-blown traumatic response mode, mm-hmm. right? can you have this? I love that balance in between.
So I want to come back to another piece that I do when I'm using this, the concept of normal distress. We in this culture do not have a concept of normal distress.
Yes.
Agreed. If it's normal, get over it. It happens to everybody.
Yep.
It can't be distressing.
Yeah, what's the big deal? Yeah.
Yeah. If it's distress, oh my God, we're all going to die.
Yep.
There's really no sense of like, and it's hard to hold the balance. Oh, it's normal. Get over it. You know, think about starving children in China, whatever. Being able to hold the accuracy of it. Yeah, this happens. This is a human thing. And it's really painful. Mm-hmm. That's accurate. That's truthful. And I'm struggling hard with it. You know? I mean, yeah. What does a client say to you when they start to cry in your office?
I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Not, this is normal. And it really fucking sucks. I said the bad word.
We've already been swearing on the podcast.
But I didn't do the F-bomb, so come on.
I think you did earlier.
Really? Did I? Oh, God.
It's all right.
Can you blip that part out?
If you'd like me to.
I would. Where was I? What were we talking about?
Well, we're talking about clients in the office apologizing, crying. Right? For crying.
Imagine a client saying to you, hand me the tissues. I'm having a normal response to something that's really, really painful. Mm-hmm. And it's not an emergency. Mm-hmm. But I need to know that you hear me and you understand that this is hard for me.
Yeah.
Imagine yourself saying something like that.
Yeah, it's so
right.
Profoundly accepting.
Right, and it's accurate.
Yeah,
and that's you know, I'm an obsessive loon about accuracy.
But I like the word accuracy here because it's almost I think bringing to light how we operationalize acceptance, because it's not like acceptance of like what you can't change and therefore like you need to put up with it. And it's not acceptance like for acceptance sake, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that in this acceptance and commitment therapy world, I know in this whole world of, you know, third wave therapies, we talk mm-hmm. a lot about acceptance, but I love this idea of accuracy, right? Like mm-hmm. to be with that stuff.
Mm-hmm. As it is.
One of my favorite things that I like to say with clients is I like to talk about how our culture is set up for us to not ever be in discomfort.
Right.
There are like, nobody's bored anymore. You know, like right. I remember before I had a cell phone, like sitting at a restaurant, just like waiting for somebody who went to the bathroom, like with my mouth open, just like
looking around and noticing that there are other people and being curious about them.
Right. Now I go to a restaurant and right. somebody goes to the bathroom. I'm like, oh, I'll check my email, see if I get any tweets. Right. Like,
this is why I don't do Twitter.
Well, or the other thing is that I remember growing up, you know, I'll say it this way. I think there's only a few places in life where we can go where you're supposed to suffer. Like the gym is one of them, right?
Yeah, I think so. Sure.
Yeah, where you're supposed to feel uncomfortable. Yeah. And so I love also what you're speaking
to. I'm having a technical issue. I need to plug my computer in, which I didn't do earlier. Sorry. Go ahead. Keep talking.
Actually, I'm going to interrupt you and I will edit this out, but now you're...
I know. I'm all weird. I know that. I got it. Oh, okay. Totally get it. I just have to reach my cord.
Oh, okay.
That's what's going on here. Like watching Mick Jagger dance. At least I know. It's just painful to watch, isn't it?
No, it's fine. It doesn't actually bother me in any way.
Well, you can't see the whole thing over here. Okay. Let me fix it. Gotcha. All right.
So one of the things that I like to talk to my clients about is this concept that we don't, in our culture, we're not very open to being uncomfortable and that we do our best to not feel uncomfortable. And so this way that you're talking about accuracy, I'm having a normal reaction to this. I'm going to have a tissue. I'm going to have some tears here, right? Like, being present with that, being accepting of what it is, like fully. It's like, I don't need to not have this.
Mm-hmm. You don't. And if you don't have it and it's appropriate to have it, that's just weird.
Yeah.
You know, there's something, you know, what we're expected to be, if you think about it, pretty emotionless, you know, not really fazed by anything, you know, get over it pretty quick. If it upsets you at all, mm-hmm. That's sociopathy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what we're all supposed to be. Yeah.
Yeah.
My thinking too is like, it's not just that we have no willingness or ability. We can't be distressed, but if we are, somebody screwed up. Mm-hmm. Either you screwed up, so I, you know, you've attacked me, yeah. Or I screwed up and I'm worthless.
Yeah.
Right. There's no concept. I mean, I even have people who are deep, 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 deep into grief looking at me and saying, what's wrong with me that I'm this upset? Mm.
Yeah.
You know, hard. I had a week off from work. I should be over this. I'm an American, you're a Canadian, so this is what Americans do with grief.
Yeah. 1 week done.
1 week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sadly, I think that may be similar here in Canada.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Joanne, let me come back to this idea of how you conceptualize working with the embodied experience around mm-hmm. sensations, around mm-hmm. memories of sensations, because it's so original and groundbreaking.
Okay. I'm pretty sure someone out there is doing this too. It's not, okay.
Well, I'm a
there's
big-
There's my weirdness. There's my weirdness. I'm just gonna let it go, okay?
I'm a workshop junkie. I'm very aware of-
This is a waste of time because it's just my crazy talking and I need to just move on, okay? So let's say someone is really, really struggling with what are called body memories, right? Yeah. And they spend a lot of time just scanning their body, looking for any sensation, because if they feel it, then I've had people say things like, they're touching me. They're mm-hmm. touching me. I feel their hands on me right now.
Yeah. And when they're in a safe place in your office, nowhere near their attacker.
Right. Right. There's no way that can be happening. Mm-hmm. You know? That just doesn't make any kind of sense. They're touching me. No, they're not. So people get into, they're touching me. They're touching me. No, they're not. Yes, they are. No, well, bring your attention to something else. Let's ground, blah, blah, blah. Let's get rid of it. Let's get rid of it. And instead to say, you're having sensations in your body and you are recalling the gang rape. Mm-hmm. So let's go back into your body and let's do some description here. I feel a tingling on my skin. Well, for people who struggle with high levels of anxiety, there's a phenomenon, there's a symptom called formication, formication, which means your skin's crawling.
Yeah.
If you're panicking enough, you're going to have crawling skin.
Yeah. You're going to experience formication.
You're going to, yeah. Right, exactly. So talking about that, oh, that's formication. That's what this is. Or something like, I mean, people don't even have a sense of what it feels like to have intestinal gas.
Yes.
Which I've heard people have.
Flatulence.
Yeah. I mean, that's not it. But sometimes, you know, it gets kind of caught up in there and there's cramps, right? They have no awareness that is, you know, they're cutting me, mm-hmm. right? I'm being cut again. So the working on accuracy and description in session, because people need a lot of coaching and training to be able to do this on their own, right? And sometimes it's, okay, we can't do the whole thing, you know, but let's pick one, you know, the tightness in your throat, right? I'm being orally raped. Okay. Describe it to me.
Yeah.
You know, and then go in it and well, it feels like, you know, there's something in my throat. Okay. That's not specific enough. It's not meticulous enough. I want the actual sensation. And it's really difficult. It's difficult to do, period. If you don't have trauma stuff going on, but it's super difficult for someone with trauma, but it's hugely, hugely valuable. I feel on this side of my throat, like the muscles are tense and pushing in, you know? And my tongue feels like it's being pulled.
Yeah.
That level of meticulousness.
I like it.
Right?
Yeah. It also very much reminds me of exposure therapy.
It is exposure therapy.
Yeah.
Yes. As it is, not as it says it is.
I love it.
So if people practice this, and it's not an easy skill to master, it's really not. So if anyone's out there thinking, oh, I'll go do that, it's really a tough skill, you know? But it's a very, very powerful skill.
I would argue, like, if you look at some of the dismantling studies on EMDR, I would argue that some of what is happening in EMDR is like what's happening right here, right? Like where you're having people try to pay attention to this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Go with it. But I like this extra element of the specificity of having them pay attention to specific sensations and to like stay with those sensations and to help them.
But we, right. But people, that whole, what do you feel in your body thing is not specific enough.
Exactly.
It's just absolutely. And specificity means that there's no way you can break it down in a more simple way. Yeah. When you get to that point, there's no more breaking it down into something simpler.
Yeah.
That's what your goal is. Yeah. You know, so people will start in, they're raping me. I feel this, you know, kind of, you know, and when your therapist asks, what do you feel in your body? Oh, I feel tightness or I feel heaviness. Sure. Not specific enough.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, so I'd even like to bring it down to something as simple as what you had mentioned in another podcast episode, right? Placing your hand on your knee.
Oh, right. Right, right. That was one of our conversations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to say the rest of it?
Well, can you feel the weight of your hand? Can you feel your hand on your knee? Yeah. Can you feel your knee under your hand, right? Like that right there, that specificity.
That precision.
It's incredible. It's so incredibly useful. And I have used it since learning that from you.
Did it work?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Did it work? Was it useful?
Yeah. Even with clients who aren't necessarily dealing with a trauma history, but folks who, let's say I might at first blush sort of say, mindfulness, right? Like, you know, proper like eyes closed, meditative kind of work wouldn't be ideal for this person. Maybe they're dealing with their mind just sort of racing and they couldn't slow down and kind of notice those sensations. And so doing something as simple as having our eyes open in the session and I'm modeling, right? Like this direct training. Yeah. Place your hand on your knee. Can you feel the weight of your hand pressing down into your knee? Can you feel your knee under your hand? Can you feel your hand on your knee? Right? Like, doing that specific.
I like to do it in a more stripped down version, which is put your knee on your hand. Can you feel your hand on your knee? Can you feel the knee on your hand?
Yeah.
Because what's going on there is exposure, acceptance, but it's also training people to move their attention.
Yes.
With body sensations.
Yes.
So they're not, they can learn that, oh, I can move my attention.
Yeah, which I think is incredibly useful.
Yeah, right? Right, exactly. Yeah. It's very cool.
So when someone experiences
something... Are you sure I came up with that? I thought you came up with that.
You definitely came up with that.
All right, okay.
Yeah, I started implementing it like that day.
Okay.
So someone who has a complex trauma history has adapted to push some of these sensations away. Mm-hmm. And
let's be specific. Let's be specific. They have learned how to turn their attention away from perceiving them.
Yeah.
There's no pushing. There's no object to push.
That's right.
There's an activity that's being done.
So the attention has turned away from those sensations. Mm-hmm. And something catches them off guard. A sensation slips through that turning away of the awareness, they become aware of it. Mm-hmm. The proprioception of someone standing too close to them in line at the coffee shop.
Right.
The shape or texture of a strawberry in their mouth.
Mm-hmm. Right when it gets mushy.
You got it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That's one that I hear pretty, you know, to that effect pretty frequently.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So their awareness, all of a sudden, that they've been turning away from those sensations. Mm-hmm. It's like, oops, I became aware of that, right?
Right.
Not good. Don't want to feel this. It's triggering a lot of nasty stuff.
Well, it's actually just a reminder. When the sensation breaks through, what does my experience tell me? It means that it got a whole lot more dangerous.
Yeah.
It got a whole lot more really dangerous.
Yeah.
You know?
Here comes the learning history.
Right. Here's the learning history. Like, what does this mean? Look at your learning history. What does it mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But saying it like that, you know, I want to come back. I mean, I think it would be hard to do this with someone who is at that place in trauma work where they're really, really, really working hard on not feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just too big of a move, you know. It's not fair. The skill set, the tech, the ability to actually feel a feeling actually isn't there. So that, you know, people have to often be taught what that means. So I think that's important to pay attention to. We often say things to people and we think it's really simple. Tell me what's going on in your body.
Yeah.
That is a phenomenally difficult thing to do.
Yes.
Right? Let's do a body scan. Fuck no. Pardon my language. Yeah. For those of you out there, I'm sorry. I have a potty mouth. Yeah. You know what I find, Tim? I bet you find this too, is that when we're moving too fast, the work goes really slow.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Get ready to go back 5 steps.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Right.
Get ready to revisit that topic.
What do you do when you realize, oh, I've been moving too fast? What do you do?
I name it.
Yeah.
I will say, I've made a mistake. Mm-hmm. Here's what I think I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Did you notice me doing this?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll even say something to the effect of the therapist that I wants to be slow, that I want to be slows down
mm-hmm.
and models the kind of right behavior here. So can we go back
mm-hmm.
and I'll,
you don't say that bit right there. You don't say the therapist that I want to be to the client.
Yeah.
That was an aside. Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, no, I'll just in kind of owning it and saying like, hey, I think like, I've made a mistake here as well. So yeah, I'll say something like, you know, the therapist that I want to be stops right here, takes a step back and does this in a much more meticulous way.
Right. But also think about what that is adding to the data bank. Now for something completely different.
You got it.
Right. So now there's a reference. It's a little teeny tiny reference and it's kind of like wet toilet paper, but it's in there.
It's there. Yeah, I like that.
It's there. Yeah, which is super cool.
Well, Joanne, how do you handle that when you notice that the work is moving quickly and that you're actually starting to backtrack?
What do you mean?
Well, when you're noticing that the benefit of moving quick, right? Like that you're not actually reaping the benefits of like the
therapy. Sometimes I don't notice, you know. Sometimes I'm like such a brilliant therapist that, you know, it has to be working, you know. My clients said, she's such a brilliant therapist. It has to be working. We're both deluded. My clients will tell me on some level. I mean, the people that I work with complex trauma are some of the most noble, just decent people I know.
Mm-hmm.
Really, just extraordinarily. I mean, I don't want to make them into saints or anything like that because, you know.
I understand.
But they're like people who are dying, you know? Have you ever worked hospice?
Some people who are hospice specifically, but I have worked with people who are dying, yeah.
Right. When people who are dying, some people come to towards the end of their life and they're like, yeah, I don't have time for this. And they're so dead honest, straightforward.
Oh yeah.
Right? And it's so rich and alive. Trauma folk can be like that, dead on, straightforward, you know? And I want to come back. And I'm going to talk about fat. We'll talk about fat more in depth in other podcasts. We don't really have time to do it here. But FAP is about talking about what's going on in the relationship at that precise moment. And my favorite part of FAP is assess your impact.
Yeah.
And so
rule four,
rule four, for those of you who are fat nerds,
rule four, give me some more.
And if you do that consistently and even almost constantly, is that right? How does that land? What do you think? Then it's less likely that you're going to be moving too fast. It's not that it won't happen, but it's less likely. And the other thing that you're doing when you do rule four is you're asking the client to do something that is really helpful, but has been hugely punished for them.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I was trying to, what I was trying to say earlier is like, if I'll catch myself moving too quickly with a client, I'll try and name it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's another huge aha relationally.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that that consistent rule fouring, we're slowly, slowly, slowly building a self.
Yeah.
Or helping the person build a self. Because the only place they can answer that question from is here. And I'm pointing to my inside of me.
Yes.
Right. Have you ever had this experience where you ask somebody, you know, how's it landing for you? And they look at you like, I don't know. How is it landing for me?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
What do you do when that happens?
This again is one of those moments where I will usually just kind of pause and try to like go slow, take a step back and start to skill up from a slower place.
Right. You're asking a question that's too hard to answer. So where do you go? Like, I mean, when you ask them, how is this landing for you? And they're like, I don't know. How is it? What do you probably say something next. You figured it out too fast, too much.
Yeah.
What do you do next?
So that's usually when I will say, like, I will try to self-identify. I'm noticing this. God, right. Are you noticing that?
Right. And if they say no,
yeah.
Or if they say yes, and you know that they're just compliant, they're just doing what they know you want to do.
Yeah. Well, and that also becomes a whole other, you know, a whole other can of worms, so to speak.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things that I'll do in that moment is actually identify it. And then I will, Joanne, literally, I will stop what we're doing in the session and we'll go back to some more, and I don't want to say elementary work, but more foundational work.
Right, exactly.
To help create a sense of a little bit of distance, if you will, like having some of these things as they are and getting into that specificity of being able to identify what it is they're seeing, what it is that they're experiencing, and creating a repertoire around that, like some language around that. And even sometimes just being able to use, like, I sometimes like to use like flavor language, like yummy, yucky.
So cool.
Right, just to create that discrimination.
That's so cool. Yeah. Wow. I'm stealing that.
Please do. Okay. Please do.
This is another thing I think that doesn't happen very often is that trauma clinicians don't get a chance to really just talk to each other, talk shop.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Or you go to a workshop and, you know, I've been to Bessel van der Kolk's workshops and trainings and all that stuff. And it's so much information. Much of which I think is not accurate. Sorry. I mean, or it's not useful. It doesn't, you know, describe. Okay, I've described it. What do I do?
Well, it's a lot like the attachment literature.
Yeah.
It talks a lot about assessing attachment and ideas about attachment, but it doesn't actually give you clinical interventions. It doesn't give you the so what or the what's next.
Right. Yeah. And that sort of nuts and bolts, like what we just did.
Yeah.
You gave me one of your tools. I've given you one of my tools.
Yeah.
We just don't have that very much in trauma work. Unless you work in a trauma center, maybe, and you're working on a team that's really connected. And that's wonderful if that's true for you. So I'm hoping in our podcast, and these conversations that you and I have, and are probably going to have more of, are like that. So if people write in or send this information like, well, what about this? I would really, really like to hear that.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think it also contributes to this sense of a more, if I may use a bit of a geek term, but more of an open source kind of community where, conversations like what we're having right now, where we share some of these tools and some of these ideas, and where we get feedback from people and are able to address mm-hmm. those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe I could share something like, if folks are aware of, there's an organization called the, oh my gosh, I haven't been involved with them for a couple of years now. ISSTD.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
International Society. And
To say that again, because I was talking over you and the poor people may not have heard it.
Of course. So it's the it's a professional association called the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation, mm-hmm. ISSTD. And they have conferences and they have a really cool sense of community. They had a study group here that I got to sit on and have some fun in the part of the world, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, where I live. Mm-hmm. And it's a really great sense of community because you have trauma therapists
right.
who are doing the work, who can commiserate with you, kind of like what we're doing right now.
That's not all that we're doing, but go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
And talk a little bit about how some of the resources that are out there maybe aren't accurate, aren't useful, aren't relevant, and how mm-hmm. you really need to be creative in your practice. Mm-hmm. I don't know, for folks who are listening, I'm going to point in the background. There's a bit of a bokeh effect on my camera. You might not be able to see it, but there is a camera in my office.
Oh.
I have a camera in my office that's on 24/7. Of course, all my clients have informed consent about this. Mm-hmm. It's not connected to a cloud or any network device of any sort. Mm-hmm. It doesn't record audio. Mm-hmm. So,
why do you have it?
Well, I record all of my sessions uh-huh. for safety reasons. And I've been attacked by a client who had a dissociative episode, right? Who
thought you were a perpetrator.
You got it.
Yeah.
You got it. And, some of the feedback that I had was, you know, Tim, this is your career. This is your livelihood. You know, you should be recording all of your session. Uh-huh. And so uh-huh. I do. And it's been incredibly valuable.
Really? Huh. That's really interesting. How do you see it as valuable?
It's there to be able to reflect on things that, mm-hmm. you know, can go, I mean, wrong for sure, but also to keep myself safe as well. There's a physical record of what happens in mm-hmm. the room.
Do you ever review tape with the client?
I have. Mm-hmm. I have. Mm-hmm. And it's been really interesting. I've had some interesting feedback around reviewing like recordings with clients mm-hmm. Where they sometimes will remark around how surprised they are that they actually tackled what mm-hmm. they did in the session. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't remember going there with you. That's mm-hmm. wow. Yeah. How about you?
Well, I'm just thinking that how interesting it would be to, I do a lot of, supervision with people with video. They bring video in and do it. And I'll often turn the sound off.
Yes.
Because there's this really rich conversation that's going on physically.
Yeah.
Right? And so like if you miss cue with a client, you can, you know, literally rewind the tape and say, right there, you were giving me a signal and I missed it. Wasn't it? Yeah. Okay. Got it. Understand. Is there a way for you to make that signal a little bigger?
Yeah.
Or do it again if I miss it.
Oh, I love that. What a great way to train that.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Yes. I'm going to try it this week before I...
Because I do it with my students. I do it all the time. So my students say, right there. Look, right there. Client just... And what you see what you did right before that? You know, you just punished something. Can you see that?
Yeah.
And... it's really helpful first students think that they're terrible and they hate themselves. But after that, it's really helpful. Yeah.
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 That's totally brilliant.
Okay.
No, I'm going to try it and I'll tell you how it works.
Try it. Yeah. Let me know how it works. Yeah. That'd be really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm tempted to get a camera in my office, but that would entail a lot of I'll think about it. That's so brilliant. That's such a great
idea.
I'm sorry you were attacked. That's really awful.
I'm
Were you hurt?
I was not hurt, and I'm okay with it. And I mean that.
Did it leave you any, did you have any flinchiness after that with that client or anyone else?
Actually, this is, I've processed this, and I'm going to share this. I'm worried that it's going to come off as an odd thing to say, but I'm really glad it happened because I kind of feel like I was a safe person for that to happen with.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And I felt like I was able to model the right response to it.
Which was?
To stand up, take a step back and say, this is not okay. This not appropriate behavior. Open the door to my office. Say, I'm opening the door to my office so that other people know what's happening in here. Mm-hmm. Right? Because this is a really confusing situation. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to take a step back and just, I'm not running away. I'm not going anywhere. I'm right here. This needs to stop now.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Thanks, Joanne.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you.
So beautiful.
And even now as I tell the story, like I just feel really positively about that. It's right about being able to do that.
Man, what a therapeutic slam dunk.
Oh, I highly recommend recording your sessions to everybody.
I know you. Yeah. Okay. I'll think about it.
I think it's cool. I have my worst session ever. Audio and video recorded by
who doesn't in IMAX. For those of you who are just listening, I'm pointing at my head.
Yeah, I liked that.
Who doesn't? Yeah. I was going to say something. I was going to ask you something. I can't remember what it was. I remember when we were at that dinner. This isn't what I was going to ask you. When we were at that dinner. The sense of just, oh God, he gets it. He understands what I'm talking about, you know, because as a functional contextualist, a lot of the places, a lot of the ways that I think about trauma and dissociation, people just look at me like I've grown a second head. You know, they just it feels really hard, you know?
Yeah. How do you make sense out of that? Like how do we get a culture where this topic, complex trauma, dissociation, where this gets taken off the table and looked at as, I liken it to Dungeons and Dragons, right? Because people talk about all kinds of silliness, like, and when the great wizard comes from the cave. And
really? Is that how it goes?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's funny.
Yeah.
So you're kind of just making stuff up and moving things on. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, it seems so fantastical and so over the top.
And so hopeless.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I've had more than one client, you know, but be willing to show me a behavior called dissociation in the room. Yeah. And they've read all of the literature, the, you know, workbooks and everything on DID, dissociative identity disorder. And they are hopeless. It's like, this is going to take the rest of my life. It's never going to. And it's like, well, no, but I understand how you would think that.
Yeah.
And sure, if you've gotten to the place in your life, if you've had the experience in your life that you've learned that skill, that one's not going to fade very fast. Oh, that's what I want to talk about. We talked about this and how enraged we get when people treat this kind of complex trauma as a bruise.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is so, I don't even have words. It's not a bruise. It's a scar.
Yes.
And in some cases, it's an amputation.
Yeah.
Let's name it.
Yeah.
But I, you know, how many clients have you had? It's like, I'm not getting well fast enough. I'm just not doing.
Yeah.
This should be over by now.
Yeah.
Well, that's what bruises do. This isn't a bruise.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember when we had that conversation, we were just like, God, let's go kill people who do that.
Yeah. Well, it's infuriating.
It is infuriating.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think it's back to that not being willing to let go of the safe and just world. Mm-hmm. You know? Oh, if it's a bruise, we could get, well, you know, and then everything goes on and it's fine. Not a bruise.
So Joanne, for our listeners, mm-hmm. resources would you recommend that they check out next in order to explore this more?
Good Lord, I don't know. Well, I think people who could be clients are listening, you may not have personal resources in your neighborhood or in your, I don't know. This kind of functional contextual approach for this kind of behavior, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, Robin wrote that book on trauma, but that's more, you know, upper level, whatever you want to call it, simplified trauma. Or simple
I would say like, so you're talking about acceptance and commitment therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder and trauma-related
right.
issues. It's very much, yeah, geared towards like single episode traumas, like
right.
motor vehicle collision,
right.
or seeing a sort of something happen, mm-hmm. maybe being involved in a combat stress situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that makes sense. It's not geared towards like complex trauma.
Well, it's not geared towards people who never had the opportunity to develop the resilience to go through a trauma like that.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it was the opposite for them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's no rebound. There's no bouncing. It's just, yeah. Yeah.
And in all fairness, I think that we're addressing this.
I think I would go to the DBT community, you know?
That's exactly what I was
thinking. I would totally go to the DBT community, you know? Because the DBT community, particularly people who've gone through DBT treatment, they're so hopeful. I mean, it's like, this is a thing you can, they talk about it as skills.
You don't have a skill.
So that's probably where I would go. Ask them to consider going to the DBT. And there's all kinds of resources for DBT online. Yeah. And we can put some in the show notes.
Absolutely. The main reason why I think I have the same reaction is, and I don't think that, you know, like there's very valuable work in using ACT for PTSD or what have you. But I like that your gut reaction was to go to DBT because the skills training is very uniform. It mm-hmm. is succinctly delivered mm-hmm. and it's done in
broken such down. It's broken down into doable steps too.
You got it. It's right. written in such a way that is immediately usable. Mm-hmm. So if you are experiencing these high levels of dysregulation, if you're experiencing, mm-hmm. You know, this turning away from mm-hmm. this evocative content, mm-hmm. it's stuff that will immediately help you with beginning to recognize that pattern, right? Because right. even the functional analysis, the chain analysis is done in a very prescribed way, which I get clinicians may have an aversion to because it's so rigid. But for the population that we're talking about, I think it's just incredibly useful.
Well, I would suggest to you that I don't think DBT should be limited to the population we're talking about. I think DBT should be taught in kindergarten.
Oh, cool.
I really do. I use DBT skills all the time personally.
Yeah.
You know, and I think too, this is my opinion. You don't take it for what it's worth. I think the most effective tool for dissociative disorder, trauma related, whatever, is to not see it as some kind of weird aberration. Mm-hmm. That it was learned. You can learn more.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not some special weirdness for you.
Yeah.
And I think maybe being in the DBT community, particularly the online groups for people who've been through DBT.
Yes.
You're so, not always, of course, but they're very like, yeah, dude, no. What's it called when the software always has a problem, known problem? Known issue.
Oh, yes.
It's a known issue, man. Totally known issue. Oh, man. You don't think it's not just me? No, known issue.
Yeah.
It's still
like that.
Matter of fact, right?
Yeah, that bug has been reported. Yeah.
That bug has been reported, right? Exactly. We're working on that one.
Yeah. I like that a lot, actually.
Yeah, I do too. Right. So that's where I would go.
I like that that was your gut reaction as well. I think that's really cool.
What would you say? Just DBT, right? We'd say the same thing.
I was actually going to say,
for those of people who don't know, is we're talking about dialectical behavior therapy.
You got it.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, that is the reason why I was going to say DBT is because, again, as you were saying, you may not have access to a clinician locally or resources. Like, I can't think of any resources off the top of my head apart from DBT skills training that would specifically address these issues. Mm-hmm. You might be able to meet a creative therapist or clinician mm-hmm. who is a functional contextualist. Maybe they're doing ACT or CFT or FAP. Mm-hmm. But we know that DBT has a set of prescribed skills. It is a protocol that would address these things with those skills. And that I do a lot of that in my practice.
Oh yeah, I do too. Yeah. And the second word in the title is behavioral.
Yes.
So I'm just gonna lay it out there. I'm a behaviorist. That's what I am. That's what I do. That's how I see the world. That's how I live. And it is the most, I really can say this without hyperbole, it changed my life enormously to see the world this way. Yeah. You know, it is all about learning. If you're in a certain context, you're going to learn certain things. You know, it's not your identity, right? It's yeah. not who you are. It's what you know how to do. You can learn to do something else. You'll always remember that other thing you know how to do because, you know, once in, always available. But it doesn't have to end there. And I find that so hopeful. You know?
Yeah.
I just find that so hopeful. So look for someone who says that they're a behaviorist. That's what I would suggest you do.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. When you say reinforcement, they nod their head and go, uh-huh.
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. What else would you suggest? What would you suggest, like, personally for someone? Not just looking for treatment, but just personally, what would you suggest? Like for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big believer in like consolidating your experience, whether it be like journaling, if journaling doesn't fit for you, bullet journaling. Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer in just having time to make sense out of your history and out of your experience mm-hmm. so that you that's here now can own that and take mm-hmm. that with you, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, rather than it looming and defining you.
Right. Exactly. Like shadowing you, overshadowing you.
Yeah.
You know, you get to step out from under that shadow and go on. It's still there. It still casts a huge shadow, but you're not completely in the shadow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think that's true. I would also say, you know, I would just say, you know, you come by this honestly.
Mm.
Right? You know?
Yeah.
You didn't wake up one morning and say, you know, my life's going pretty well. I think yeah. I'm going to develop dissociative identity disorder and freak everybody out around me.
Yeah.
And ruin my life. Yeah. That's not how it goes. Yeah. You know? It's not how it goes. Yeah.
That's very powerful.
Are we coming to the end, you think?
Yeah.
We exhausted our ability to converse about this for now.
We haven't.
We have not.
I guarantee you, we
haven't. But for now, we have.
Yeah. So I would love to hear from our listeners feedback mm-hmm. that you have, questions, because that gives Joanne and I things to go off of, grist for the mill for us to discuss yeah. on the podcast. So please yeah. don't hesitate to write us actincontextpodcast@gmail.com or yeah. tweet at us.
One thing I need to say, though, we cannot answer clinical questions, specific clinical questions, because we don't know you. We don't know your situation. Exactly. And it's unethical, but it's also just not workable and it's not right.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, we can't give clinical advice to anyone.
Yeah. I really appreciate you saying that. Mm-hmm.
It's not because you don't deserve it. It's because we don't know what to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, asking us your questions, whether you have emails that you want to send us, but you can also send us in video questions as well. Mm-hmm. We'd love to get your feedback.
That would be super cool. I'd like to see that.
So we did it.
We did it again. We have so much fun doing this.
I'm having a lot of fun working with you, Jordan.
Me too. Yay for us, man. Right. This is so much fun. Yeah. So
Don't forget, you can email us anytime. We're going to give you some links to resources in the show notes. So check those out from however you consume this podcast. Or remember, you can watch it as a video podcast as well if you'd like to do that.
Boy, you are so good at that stuff, what you just did there. I mean, it's just so smooth and elegant. You're just good at that. Yeah, I really do. You know, me watching Mick Jagger dance, I'd be stammering and stuttering. And you're just, it's just beautiful. I love watching you do that.
Oh, thanks, Joanne.
Yeah.
I'm having a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, you're a natural. All right.
And of course, we'll say one last time, thank you to Marcel.
Thank you to Marcel. Thank you, Tumors. And thank you for listening, you know? Yeah.
All right, folks.
And if you think this is useful, pass it on. Let people know about it.
Yeah, that's super helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Take care.
See you next time.